Hi, this is Barbara Peters, and once again I'm sitting here at Virtue with a certain amount of ambient noise, but it's a real treat to be talking to Anne Hillerman, who has launched her new book, her fifth baby, The Tale Teller, tonight at the Poison Pen. Anne.
I am so happy to be here in Scottsdale, and I'm just delighted to see The Tale Teller finally hit the light of day.
Of course you are. It is like giving birth every time, isn't it?
It is.
I noticed that during your wonderful talk and slideshow presentation tonight, you referred to each of the books as my baby, which I thought was fun. So a question I wanted to ask you is, you know, how do you pick the various locations for the books, now five? And do you actually consciously want to avoid places that your dad picked?
I really start the stories with the location.
Do you?
Yeah, I do. And it's not that I want to avoid places that my dad wrote about, but there are so many other wonderful, wonderful places on the Navajo Nation that it's kind of fun to take readers to some place that they haven't been before. So that's part of my thinking when I start a new book.
I think that's a really smart decision. How big is the Navajo Nation? It's huge.
It's huge. It's 17 million acres.
Wow.
More than that, more than 17 million acres.
So, in so far, places you've been that he has not been, Monument Valley, for example?
Right, that's right. I was really surprised that he hadn't set a book at Monument Valley, because it just seems, I mean, it's such a beautiful landscape, and it has so many places where evil could go unnoticed. So, but I think Dad, Dad loved traveling around the Navajo Nation, and Monument Valley was kind of a far drive from him from Albuquerque. So, I think maybe that was one reason he never used it, or maybe he just thought it was a cliche. But anyway, I used it and I loved it. But for the Tale Teller, I don't use Monument Valley. I use the area near Window Rock.
No, you absolutely do. And I was thinking back to Monument Valley. Maybe he thought it was owned by John Ford.
Well, you know, it could be.
I mean, think about Stagecoach and all those movies.
Right.
But, you know, and for a long time, it was only Gouldings that you could actually go to Monument Valley and stay in. But now that they have opened the view,
which
I have to tell you, it's really spectacular for the view going east. And I didn't realize until Rob and I, my husband and I, stayed there, how beautiful the territory right behind the Navajo, because it's a Navajo-run reservation. Navajo-run
hotel.
How beautiful that was. I mean, it's like a two-hour drive over unpaved roads into all this gorgeous stuff.
Yeah.
But maybe your dad just felt that, you know, it wasn't his.
I think that's right. And also, I think he liked places where there were more people, because then that made it easier to put the story together. Whereas there are some families that live in Monument Valley, but not so many. So
that's very true.
Yeah.
For years, and I was so glad to see them resurrected for you, there was this wonderful map called Hillerman Country.
Right.
And I'm delighted that the company that makes it not only brought it back with your dad's books, but updated it to include yours.
I was thrilled. The guy who does that map, he's a gentleman named Frank Lister. And he is the son of two wonderful archaeologists, who worked in the Colorado Plateau for a long time. And I was so honored when he wanted to include my books in that map. But he doesn't have the Tale Teller in there yet. Have to do a new edition.
Well, he will. He did one last year that incorporated all of the ones that you've written so far, so maybe he'll just skip a couple of years. So I don't know that you can reasonably expect him to do one every single year.
I guess not.
But it's fun. They just fly out of the store. It's really remarkable to see how many people buy them. I have used them as a tour guide. Have you?
Yes, I have. I have. I really like them.
I do too.
Yeah.
All right,
yeah.
So let's see. You've been to, tell me a little bit about El Mapais, which I think is a fascinating place.
I love that setting. It's a giant lava flow that's near Grants, New Mexico, right off of I-40. And it extends to the very edge of the Rama Navajo Reservation, The people who live in Zuni Pueblo, Acoma Pueblo, Laguna Pueblo, all have wonderful stories that have to do with the origins of that lava. So when I was working on Cave of Bones, it just seemed like the ideal place. And also, Cave of Bones involves somebody who gets lost and basically disappears in the lava. And there was exactly a case like that that happened. And so I was able to kind of use the search for, it was a family that disappeared, use the information about that search and incorporate real life stuff in my mystery, which was great. And then I was able to bring in Joe Leaphorn, who of course was around when those first people got lost, and use him as a consultant. So it's just, the Navajo Nation has so many wonderful sites, and adjacent to it are also so many other wonderful sites. We're just lucky to be in the Southwest, where we don't have to invent everything, where we can just focus on stories and characters and not have to come up with the settings, because nature's already provided them for us.
Well, that absolutely was the feature of your dad's books, and certainly is the feature for yours. I was trying to remember, see, you've been back to Chaco Canyon, where your dad was, but you chose to do a different part of it.
Right.
And you've been in Santa Fe, where, right, again, this was all true.
Right, right, right.
Let me try to think. Where else have you gone where he hadn't gone before you?
Well, I talk about Tuba City, which, okay, Dad had never, he's mentioned it, but he never really said a story there. So in Song of the Lion, there's a big meeting between a lot of groups who have a lot at stake about development of a resort at the Grand Canyon, of basically a mediation session. And I was able to set that in Tuba City. So then I was able to talk about the dinosaur tracks, which are between Tuba City and the Grand Canyon. And I was able to bring in some of the Hopi influence, because Tuba City and Moenkopi are basically across the street from each other in that part of Arizona.
Well, yeah, they absolutely are. And in fact, you know, we were talking tonight about La Posada, the wonderful old railroad hotel that's been restored up in Winslow. But just north of it is a small reservation. I'm going to mispronounce it. Is it Julia? I can't remember who they are. Hulapai?
Wallapai.
Wallapai, thank you. And then north of that, in fact, you wind up in Hopi land, which your dad used, I think, in just one book, The Sacred Clowns? Or did he use them in more?
He used it in, now I'm having to think about this, he used it in Dark Wind.
He did.
That's the story where there's a plane crash, there's desecration of Hopi shrines at water sources. I'm not remembering the whole story right now, but I know that was the one that was filmed partly in Moenkopi. And the Hopi, it was an interesting story. The Hopi tribal council said, sure, it's fine with us. And then when Robert Redford started filming that movie, the other people who were not represented by the Hopi tribal council said, hey, wait a minute, we don't know what's going on here, and we probably don't like it.
Uh-huh.
Yeah. So.
Well, I remember Sacred Clowns in particular. He also went in Dance Hall to the Dead of the Dead to the Zuni Reservation.
That's right. Yeah.
And you know, so you always have the option of going back there. I'm actually wearing my Zuni bracelet.
Oh, it's beautiful.
It is beautiful.
I wish people could see it on the podcast.
Well, I know, but the Zuni tend to do what I sort of think of as turquoise pointillism.
Right.
You know, as it compared to Navajo jewelry, which has
bigger
larger
stones,
Yeah, exactly. Yeah. In fact, I'm wearing my mom's squash blossom necklace here as we're doing all that. So, you know, there are places where he went that you could go back and revisit in a different way, like
sure,
the Zunis or the Hopi or the people north of La Posada.
Oh, sure.
But what interested me is that the number of Navajo reservations that are splintered off the main, I always thought of it as just like one giant reservation. But your books have pointed out that there are some small dotted around, for example, by the Malpais. And then are you looking at one that's over by Socorro?
That's right. There are actually three parts of the Navajo reservation that aren't connected to the big reservation.
Okay.
And there's the Rema, which you mentioned, which is near the Malpais, near Zuni, sort of. And then there's Tahajale, which is close to Albuquerque and close to the Acoma. And then there's the one that I'm working about in my new book, which is called the Alamo Reservation, which is kind of on the other side of the Alamo people, the Alamo Pueblo, not Alamo, I'm sorry, the Acoma Pueblo people, but not really adjacent to it. They're, the Alamo Navajos are sort of just out by themselves, like a little island of Navajos.
How did that happen? Was that a result of the long walk when
well,
it splintered everybody out?
It depends on who you ask. There are some stories that say these were Navajos when we were walking back after the treaty that created the Navajo Nation. They got tired of walking, and okay. They said, we're just going to settle here. There's another story that says the people who settled there were the descendants of Navajo slaves who'd been basically kidnapped and sold by the Spanish. They had been working on rancheros and placitas in the Socorro along the Rio Grande Valley, and they had run away from their captors and established a settlement there at Alamo. And then there's another story which says this is where the holy people put us. This is where we've always lived. This is our traditional homeland.
That's fascinating. When you look at a map of New Mexico, it's amazing to see all the different. How much of New Mexico do you know is actually reservation? Because in Arizona, it's a huge percentage.
I know it is in New Mexico. There's 19 different tribes in New Mexico.
And then you have the whole Pueblo community as distinct from the Navajo community.
Right, and even in the Pueblos, you have like four different Pueblo languages, and I mean it's.
And then you have the Apache, you have the Hickory Apache, I think it is, and then the
Mescalero.
The Mescalero Apache and so forth. So, you know, when you think about all the things that happened to the Indians and how they were splintered up, I guess it's no surprise that they've come down in kind of like a jigsaw puzzle rather than a coherent whole, isn't it?
Yeah.
But
yeah,
your dad was so interesting that he was so intrigued with that and chose to write about them and really pioneered stories about, I think, non-Anglo-European people in the Southwest.
Right. And I think one of his really brilliances was that his Navajo characters, his Pueblo characters, his Apache characters were not stereotypes. They were real people with real talents, real problems. I think partly because Dad had grown up in Oklahoma surrounded by different Indians who'd been dislocated from their original lands, Potawatomis, Seminoles,
right.
Alt Cherokee, Chickasaw. I think it gave him an appreciation for how just saying Indian is not saying enough, that there is so much diversity and variety and so much wealth in these cultures that all of us can learn from.
Well, he was always respectful and affectionate, I think, you know, about it. And it's wonderful the reception that he got. But you know what? You're your own writer. You aren't really, you know, it's hard to get you out of your dad's shadow. But as you've now done 5 books, you know, you've really emerged as a voice and identity of your own. Are you proud of that?
I am. I have to tell you a funny story. So I did an event in Santa Fe, and I was stopping to get a pizza. And I pull up, and there's this pickup truck that pulls up next to me, and this guy who's about 250 pounds gets out of the pickup, and he's got tattoos and lots of earrings and sunglasses, even though it's night. And he says, "Hey, I know you. You're Ann Hillerman." I say, "Yeah?" He says, "I'm Sky. I'm an Apache." And then he says, "Oh, I love your work. I have to give you a hug. And then we have to take a selfie."
Oh, I love that. Well, good for you.
It cracked me up.
I love it, though. But, you know, I remember how, you know, we had these discussions before you ever started to write again about Leigh Porn and she and Bernie, who's kind of your lead character. And I remember how, you know, uncertain you were about how well that would work. So I'm really delighted to see that you've come into an identity and a voice of your own.
Well, and I really appreciate all the support that you and Poison Pen have given me over the years. And the people who come to your events are just so wonderful. And so many of them say, "Oh yeah, I remember meeting your dad and blah, blah, blah." And then they say, "I would have hated for those stories to end, and I'm really glad that you're continuing." And then they say, and this makes me the happiest, they say, "And I love Bernie, and I think it was time for a woman to step forward." So,
I think
yay.
That's true. It's lucky that your dad kind of discounted her and left her for you, isn't
yeah.
it?
It really is.
Very far-seeing of him.
Well, someone... Go ahead. I was just going to say, someone at the event tonight said, you know, maybe he didn't really... Maybe he did leave her for you on purpose. And I thought, I hadn't thought of that. But
he might have. It might have been a legacy.
It might have been.
Well, even though...
Oh, thanks, Dad.
Yeah, absolutely. And even if it wasn't intentional, it's worked out that way.
It sure has.
You can't ask for a lot more than that, can you?
I don't.
Thank you very much, Ed.